listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
In the 1970s, I was in therapy with a remarkable woman, Shirley Luthman. My marriage had disintegrated and I began to fall apart. I felt like I was going crazy, in fact. Shirley was unperturbed. "You're going through the identity crisis process," she explained patiently. "You feel like you're falling apart. You are. The person you have thought yourself to be is breaking apart because a deep inner part of you is helping you get back to who you really are. There is nothing wrong with you. You just have to fall apart before you can find out who you really are. The person you covered over in your childhood because she was not a safe person to be at that time." I could hardly believe her. Shirley asked me to trust her. I felt like I couldn't stop the process, and eventually I went all the way through it. And she was right. I felt reborn, whole, rejuvenated, and connected to myself and my world. Since then, working as a psychotherapist, I've helped many, many people to thrive through the same process. But I hadn't refined it the way we'll be talking about it today with my guest, psychologist Dr. Susan Plummer, who is the author of Deep Change. Welcome to Full Power Living, where we bring you a wide variety of guests and programs with the aim of understanding the power and importance of human emotions. We are broadcasting over blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living and emotionalpro.com. We also distribute through iTunes, and we invite you to call and offer your ideas and also ask questions. Our number is 888-498-0570. That's toll-free, 888-498-0570. So now, Dr. Susan P. Plummer is the director of the Santa Barbara Alliance for Living and Dying Well, which is a consortium of major end-of-life care services and providers in the Santa Barbara, California area. She's also been director of a certified hospice program for 8 years and holds a doctorate degree from the Saybrook Institute. And she and I are both alums of the Berkeley School of Social Welfare in Berkeley, California. She's a licensed psychotherapist and had a part-time practice for over 25 years. Well, starting at a very young age, Dr. Plummer had a curiosity about other dimensions, which grew into a passionate lifetime interest in experiences of major life transitions. She began to investigate those under the guidance of a leading theorist, Dr. Amadeo Giorgi. Her recent book, Deep Change, Befriending the Unknown, grew out of this doctoral research. Her website is susanpplummer.com. That's P is Susan P. P-L-U-M-M-E-R, so two P's and two M's, .com. Dr. Susan Plummer, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you, Eileen. I look forward to our conversation.
Well, I'm really excited to talk with you today because you're working to help people in a way that's similar to what I've been doing for nearly 40 years, but which I've found that very few people, for sure, and not very many therapists even know about. And what you're talking about is this process I described myself going through. And I'd like you to tell us what this deep change issue is from your point of view, please.
Okay, well, that's a very big question.
Get ready.
Okay, my perception of deep change, and by the way, my research is very descriptive, so it's not theoretical and it's not analytical. It's really describing what we experience when we cooperate with this phenomenon I'm calling deep change. And in deep change, we can compare it to what you might call horizontal change. We really change intrinsically, and we really let go of one way of being in relation to ourselves in the world, and we open to a brand new way that we really can't even imagine until we arrive. And in deep change, there are people that are seeking that kind of change in different kinds of spiritual contexts or existential. And then I think there are many people that are being called to deep change and don't have the understanding of that. And I'm really, really passionate about wanting to bring that understanding more into the world, because many people are feeling, for example, a sense of emptiness or disorientation or a sense of being lost. And really, those are often threshold experiences that that tell us we are being called into a new way of being. And I think it's essential we start to understand that. One of the important things about deep change, which really runs counter to really a lot of our kind of Western paradigm, that in deep change, I feel like we are longing to come into a different way of being in the world. But at the same time, there is a different dimension, a deeper dimension, we could say, in the world that is longing for us to come into a more authentic way of being so that we can join and co-create with that other dimension. And so in deep change, we're actually involved in a dynamic relationship with something other and larger than ourselves that is pulling and calling us into a more essential self again so that we can be in kind of a state of being in which we can join and co-create new worlds and new ways of being, which we desperately need right now. So that's kind of just a summary, Eileen. I can talk about the seven shifts, but should we just stop right there?
Let's stop right there because I will be asking you about those seven shifts.
Okay.
Because I want to look at a little bit more around that. Thank you for explaining that. I like the way you put that. A big part of your concern, as I picked it up, is that we don't allow ourselves the opportunity to explore the depths of our own change process. And so we're really missing out on an opportunity to move, as you're describing, from an old way of being to a new way of being, or a more, what for me, having gone through it, is a more self-connected way of being.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that we don't go deeper is our culture says, oh, if you're having any kind of discomfort or pain, you should pop a pill.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about something called future busting around this. So what is this that gets in the way when we take medications? It gets in the way. Why is that?
Well, I think that we have to be a little bit careful because certainly there is a role for medications, you know, in certain situations, and I have a respect for that. But my feeling, Eileen, is that we are prescribing anti-anxiety and anti-depression medications very indiscriminately. And someone is like a little sad or a little empty, and they're called depressed. And one way I look at this is I think that the Inuit Indians up in Alaska have 20 words for snow because there's so many different kinds of snow, and we have one word, depression. And we prescribe them without any reflection on the etiology of it, or why now? Why now is this occurring for someone? And so I feel like when we're being pulled into a new future, we often come to, at first, some part of us is dying, and the world can feel flat and meaningless, and really we need to be very present with those experiences. And when people take these medications, often it sort of flattens that out, and they no longer feel that edge. And I want to tell a little story here of a woman who read my book. She's in my town, and she was at a retreat that I was leading. And she wanted to, after she read my book, she wanted to have tea, and we met. And she said that she had been feeling, she realized she was in the stilling, which is the fourth shift we'll talk about, but it can be one of the most challenging. And she identified where she was. And she said in the past she would have think, oh gosh, I think I need to be on antidepressants again. But instead, she let herself just stay and be with that stilling. But what she felt like at that time, the metaphor she used is that her rose bush had been so pruned back that she thought it was dead. There'd be no new growth. And as she just let herself stay with that, she was driving one day with her husband somewhere, and suddenly in her imagination she realized there were new buds on her rose bush. This is very moving to me. And she said if she had taken the medication, it would have dulled that. It maybe would have relieved her from some of the angst, you know, of the experience, but that was very profound to me, that description. But she said in the past, the medications kind of dull. They dull our capacity to really be in that new opening that's emerging. And I feel that we're really robbed of our birthright. And I call it future busters because we really are being called into a new future, you know, one that we can't yet imagine. I was thinking that, you know, a lot of our Western psychology is really a psychology of the past. You know, we're always dealing with what happened in the past. And what would it be like if we had a psychology of the future? Why now is this person feeling this? I think because they're being really pulled into something new. Again, I know that medications have a role at certain times, but I think we really need to take a deeper look at what is the impact of those on our culture.
Right. When I work with people in therapy, I say you can go and get medication if you wish, but the process you're involved in is not going to stop. And what I have observed medication does is make it take longer. Doesn't make it any better, just makes it take longer.
Right.
And the other thing you keep talking about, future, one of the phrases in helping people to go through this that I've developed is, you can't see tomorrow with today's eyes.
That's very good.
All right. Now, in my experience, when I work with people, there's usually been some kind of experience. Like I went into it when I had gotten married at age 19. I had a child, and suddenly here I am 29 years old, and my husband decides he's not ready to be a father, even though we created her consciously together, right? And he leaves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that threw me into the identity crisis process, or the deep change process,
mm-hmm.
as you know it. And yet, in your book, you say that not everybody has some kind of intense experience or loss or change or whatever. I mean, positive changes like marriages can do it also. But I was interested in that. What happens when somebody doesn't have a huge defining moment that starts this process? What does occur?
Well, I think there's a lot of mystery here. And I give an example. I used to run bereavement groups up north. And, for example, I'd see two women, same age, married for the same length of time. Their husbands died. You know, positive marriages. One of them will go through, they're both going through grief. And one of them is, I can see, going through deep change, as I call it. And the other is going through kind of your normal grief. So why is that? You know, I think that, let me put it this way, we human beings, we want to grow. We want to keep becoming, and we also want to stay on safe ground. And that's just the paradox of being human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of the time when we're not in deep change, those two poles are sort of balanced, so we have kind of an equanimity. In deep change, for some reason or another, it could be a crisis or it could just be that there's a very deep pull on us to enter deep change, we become more available to the pull of growing and transformation. And I think when someone has a crisis, they can, a part of their identity, as you were talking about in your own life experience, falls away or is no longer available. And that, to the extent that that identity was keeping us in a habitual way of relating to ourselves in the world, a familiar way, the extent that that was had a hold on us, when that goes away, then we become more available to that pull, to that longing to become, and available to the pull from those other dimensions that are wanting us to come into our truer self. So
mm-hmm.
I look at those two women in grief, and I think that one way I understand the difference of their experience is the role that that relationship had on the identity of one woman was different than the other.
Oh,
so
yes.
So I think that that has something to do with it, because in my 20s, when I first had this experience, there wasn't a major crisis. That was so confounding for me. You know, just suddenly my world kind of flattened and was no longer meaningful. So, but I think the crisis doesn't create the deep change pull, but I think it makes us more available to it.
Mm-hmm.
It can. It doesn't necessarily. People can go through a crisis and they don't go through deep change. You know, they somehow are able to put things back together the way they were. So I think there is a mystery here about why, you know, that occurs for some people and not others. That
well,
answer
now,
your question, yeah.
Yes. One of the things that I have surmised, and again, it's a description and an observation, as you're saying, is that I find that people to whom truth really matters are the ones who go through the process.
Interesting.
It's like we developed, just in my case, I developed a picture of who I was.
Yes.
That really was not who I was.
Mm-hmm.
Shirley used to talk about it in having survival contracts, where we'll give up little parts of ourselves or become different than we really are in order to stay connected to our caretakers' parents as we're growing up and make sure that we're loved all the way to adulthood. And so you end up with this overlay of being somebody that you aren't really.
Mm-hmm.
And my observation is that there are some people who just can't stand it. It's not true. And that's,
mm-hmm.
and they fall apart easily in this process, or they take it up. So have you found any connection between lovers of truth and deep change?
I haven't thought about it that way, Eileen. I think that there are certainly people that are more, well, maybe this is what you're saying, more sensitive to the authentic. I also
yep.
think it's important to keep a respect for the mystery of this about, for example, my mother is a wonderful, loving woman. I don't think she's ever gone through deep change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's had three husbands die, and I don't know why. she goes through her grief, but she has never experienced it. She doesn't really understand when I talk about it. So I just have to respect that. You know, I don't know the destiny of somebody. And I wouldn't say that she's not interested in the truth. She's probably not a seeker, you know. Anyway, I just, you know, it's just hard to say. Those survival contracts, I like that language you used. Maybe some people can't afford to move out of that, you know, in their lifetime. I don't really know the reasons, but...
I didn't mean to indicate that people, that all people, that only people who love truth go through this, or that if you don't go through it, you're not a truth seeker. Okay. So now your research and your therapy work led you to identify these seven shifts you've been talking about and which are in your book, The Seven Shifts of Deep Change. And you say that they're a lot like the stages that have been identified as we go through grief. And I would note that in part of the process, anyway, we are grieving for lost parts of ourselves or never realized parts of ourselves. So I want to go through each of these stages, and we have time for the first one before our break. So tell us about unsettling, please.
Okay. So I was just talking about those two poles that we have in terms of wanting to grow and become and transform ourselves, and also we want to stay on familiar ground. In the unsettling, that balance is unsettled, and we start to feel a pull. And often the first experience in the unsettling is that, you know, things don't make sense anymore, things aren't right anymore, either in the world. We maybe start to feel disconnected from ourselves and the world. It can be kind of a strange experience. We can become unfamiliar to ourselves. And we can feel sometimes a sense of lack. There's something missing. Like, is this all there is? What is the point? Those are some of the things that people talk about. And what is happening in the unsettling is, as you say, it's ultimately very good news, but it doesn't feel that way at first. And there is a, we're often more aware of that sense of lack, a sense of being fundamentally flawed in some way. But also in the unsettling, there is an awakening of this longing to connect and come into ourself in a new way. And that longing, again, is coming from both ourself and this new promise, this other dimension. And the longing, I think we're already in relationship to it in the unsettling, but we aren't necessarily conscious of it. It's as though a part of ourself has gone ahead of ourselves and is connected to a real possibility that belongs to us, but we can't get there from here. As you said, you can't see a new future with today's eyes. But we're feeling the pull of it, and it can be very confusing, and things can feel very disorienting. And we try to get back to our usual balance and way of being in the world. And when deep change really... when we really cooperate with it, you cannot get back to your old way, which is also good news. So the unsettling is really marked by this appearance of a profound sense of lack or missing, and if we can tune into it, a real longing, a palpable longing for there must be another way, because we're already somewhat aware that there is another possibility.
Oh, that's beautiful. I like the way you say that. It's time for our break. I'm talking today with Dr. Susan Plummer, who's a psychologist. She's redirecting our thinking to help us move into transformation by understanding and welcoming deep change. We're talking about the seven stages of, or actually the seven, what are those called, shifts of deep change. And we're all, in the next section of the show, we're going to be talking about the unraveling, which in my experience is what's happening when most people show up in a psychotherapy office. So come on back for more here on Full Power Living. Everybody feels anger. But if you don't learn to deal with it, anger can mess up your life. It can cause you relationship problems, difficulties on the job, or create health problems. If you want a way to understand and work with anger that's simple yet so powerful, it helps you to put an end to the specific angers that are messing up your life, then you'll want to get a copy of a mini course I've created for you entitled Reduce Anger Now. With it, I want you to be able to figure out what's stimulating the anger you feel and have an easy way to change that anger so you can dramatically reduce the anger in your life. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, longtime psychotherapist, coach, and anger expert. I've helped thousands of people to master anger, and I want you to begin to become an anger master in your life. Order Reduce Anger Now at the store, www.emotionalpro.com. That's www.emotionalpro.com. All right, welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Next week, we're looking at addictions and recovery with Lee McCormick. He has a book called Spirit Recovery Medicine Bag, and he's founded and worked in three successful addiction recovery centers. And in those centers, he follows both spiritual and ordinary recovery steps. So I think you'll find it very interesting. Listen next Thursday, August 28th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. I also want to invite you to sign up at emotionalpro.com to be on our mailing list. We send out a twice-weekly newsletter that tells you what's coming up on the show, and also you get occasional newsletters that announce some of the things that I'm doing. For example, I'm going to be going to Ireland next month to give a presentation at LinkedIn Parenting 2.0's Life Skills for Children conference. That's in Dublin next month, and that's really exciting that so many of us meeting to talk about making sure that our children get life skills that make their lives easier for them. So go to emotionalpro.com and sign up, please. My guest today is psychologist Susan Plummer. She's the director of the Alliance for Living and Dying Well. And before we dive into more of the shifts, Susan, I want to know more about what you do at your center.
Oh, well, the Alliance for Living and Dying Well is a collaboration in Santa Barbara of agencies and leaders and foundations who are really committed to making sure we have the highest quality of end-of-life care here. And part of the mission, which is really transformational, is that we want to provide opportunities for people in the community to experience that relationship between living and dying well. And many people that are involved in end-of-life care, it's kind of a secret. Sometimes if people, not always, but sometimes someone gets a diagnosis or a loved one does, what really matters becomes more in the foreground, and we start to live more meaningfully and compassionately. So the idea is maybe we don't need to wait for a crisis, but if we lived every day more conscious of our mortality, then we may live more compassionately and fully and meaningfully. So we have different kinds of community events, film series, plays, events where people have an opportunity to have actual community discussions about this relationship between living and dying well, and there's a real hunger for that. Another big part of what we're doing is we're providing opportunities for people to have the kinds of conversations that result in a meaningful advanced health care directive, whereby people really consider what does quality of life mean to them, and have conversations with family members and actually put their desires and preferences for treatment when they can't express themselves, if that occurs, and identify someone who can speak on their behalf at the time when maybe they can't speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's just a little snapshot of what we're up to.
That's really great. My older sister came and stayed with us the last 7 months of her life. Mm. And then a couple of years, that was in 2005, and a couple of years ago my husband was in the hospital in and out pretty intensely for a while. And prior to that, I really hadn't understood, and I want to emphasize this for you who are listening, I hadn't understood how important it was to have these things handled, because...
Yeah.
To know what somebody you care about wants, and to my sister, for example, was looking for greater understanding about death as she was
mm-hmm.
dying,
mm-hmm.
and And my husband, I went and just lived in the hospital with him for a couple of weeks so I could make sure to protect him like a mama bear. make sure I could find all his... And he's a doctor, you should know, Susan. He's a doctor. But he needed protection, too.
Yeah.
All right, so I want to leave time to get to all these shifts because I think that they're really important. The second one is the opening. So
yes.
Tell us about that.
Okay, so we were talking about the unsettling. In the opening, once we can, sometimes people say they're trying to get resettled and they can't, nothing's working, and they feel like they've come to the end of their rope or hitting a brick wall, and they start to realize, boy, there's nothing I can do here. I'm really helpless. I cannot fix whatever this is that's gnawing at me. And when that time comes, it's a very important part of the opening, is we can either go into resignation or despair about that, or we can accept it and allow it's just true. I do not know what to do or where to go. And that's a real pivotal point right there, and we can talk more about that if you want to. But when we can just go, it's true, I don't know what to do, I don't know where to go, and we allow ourselves just to be there, often what happens is we come into our own individual experience. For example, with my clients, I'll often say, okay, what are you experiencing? They say, well, I'm experiencing emptiness. And often we have stories around that, or I'm experiencing loneliness. And the stories would be, I'm lonely because I'm unlovable, I'm lonely because... But in the opening, we eventually drop the stories, which I think are our greatest source of suffering, and come into just the lived experience. Okay, what does loneliness feel like in your body? And where is it? And what happens is we kind of stop trying to fix or change and come into allowing and dwelling in the very experience itself. And so one way I say into your body, but I mean body subject, you know, into our own individuality. And, for example, someone might come into a sense of emptiness. Often it's in their heart. And as they let themselves dwell there, they become available to the pull of the longing, which is actually pulling us down into a deeper part of ourselves. So the opening means an opening to a new dimension in ourself. And then we become available to the unraveling, as you said. Mm-hmm. But it really is kind of a time of letting go of trying to change ourselves and the world and say, okay, where am I? What am I experiencing? And coming into this opening to the possibility of coming into a deeper part of ourselves, a more authentic part of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And one thing I just want to say at the opening, and there's a lot to talk about with this, but, you know, Thoreau talks about swamps as being tender places on the earth's surface, and I love that, and I use that in my book because I think that in the opening, where we are really truly open to the unknown, and that's what we're talking about, unknown self, unknown world, unknown future, are our tender places. It's where we're open to being experiencing joy and also hurt. So when we're being called into deep change, it's confusing because we might be called into the very place that we've spent our whole life avoiding. And because in the tender place, in those openings on the in ourselves, is where there might be old hurt that we once experienced and moved away from, or new kinds of experiences that we have, you know, yet to feel that are feel threatening. But it's important to recognize that because it can feel confusing, like, oh, I shouldn't go there. No, mm-hmm. But that's exactly where we need to learn to dwell in. And maybe I'll stop there with the opening.
Yeah, you remind me, some years ago I came to the conclusion, or I came to an observation that when we're young, we tuck away things when if we feel like we're not safe, we tuck things away, and we tuck away what may feel like our greatest tenderness, but really is our greatest ability, our greatest potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true.
And so I'm hearing you say that's what actually gets unlocked. And of course, we would get scared because we initially lock it away because we think it's not safe to let it out.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
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 And we just need a better understanding of that, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I remember my therapist used to just say, this part of the process is that the things that have worked for you to straighten things out in the past, they're not going to work. And you can just watch them fall down like dominoes in a mm-hmm. line. Mm-hmm. And it was scary, but it was also comforting. And I'm sure this is so when people work with you, is that it was comforting to know somebody knew the heck what was going on.
Right.
And they could tell me, there is an end to this process, you know. You mm-hmm. will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's really great that's happening. And, of course, I'm sure you've had that experience, too, where people will look back at you and go, give me a break. This cannot be good enough.
Right, exactly.
So,
yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the unraveling, because it really is the place where I think people decide, that's it, I've got to go get some help.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, the unraveling is really, people often experience it as kind of a descent. People might experience, I don't know if you've had this experience, Eileen, with people you work with, but they'll often describe that they're going down a dark tunnel or mm-hmm. into a cave or a well. And mm-hmm. in that journey, I mean, it can feel very frightening, but what is happening is whatever we need to let go of in order to meet and join with this other dimension that is pulling on us and longing for us, whatever is in the way that's separating us from that deeper belonging connection needs to drop away. So it's actually very merciful, but as you say, it does not feel that way often. And so we meet different aspects of ourselves, as you say, way we have survived, maybe experiences that we once visited and then repressed because we couldn't handle them at that time. We come into those maybe decisions we made that we didn't know we did that were really, as you said, decisions to bury or cover over some very essential parts of ourselves. So there's a lot of grief in the unraveling, and it's really important to develop the capacity to just dwell with those experiences and try to stay very descriptive, because the stories abound and the stories are so wedded to the actual experience. And it's so important to tease those out, because I think that what happens in a lot of Western psychology is we get so caught up in the stories themselves as opposed to just being able to dwell with the experience. And there is a lot of grief because there is something dying, and there mm-hmm. also can be what I call a an anticipated annihilation. The annihilation doesn't occur. We find, but we sense that sometimes there's something threatening, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Images of death can come up because mm-hmm. there is something dying. And the unraveling, all the shifts, by the way, can take a very short time or a long time. Again, there's a mystery here in terms of what our particular destiny is. So I want listeners to understand that we don't necessarily march through these shifts in a very orderly linear way. We might go into the unraveling, and then we go back into the opening for a little while, so not to get too concerned about exactly where am I, mm-hmm. but it can be very orienting and navigational to have an idea of these experiential shifts.
Yes.
So the unraveling can take a long time, or it can be very, very short.
And that is the real value of the book you've written, Deep Change, is that a person, I'm thinking as you're talking, that it was so important to me to have somebody I could go to and say, oh my gosh, what happened this week, or this is never going to end, or I did this wrong, or, you know, this hurts so badly. To be able to go to somebody and offer that and have them say, well, you know what, you're actually right on track, you're doing exactly what you need to do, just hang in there with it,
mm-hmm.
that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody's going to be able to get that, and that's one of the benefits of the book that you've written. They can go and review, well, okay, I'm in this process, here's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm thinking about death or maybe thinking I might die, but it doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to, you know.
Right. I think that is, I really hope it does provide that kind of orientation and comfort, and that others have gone through this before, because it can feel so strange. One thing I want to mention that in the unraveling is that what's unraveling is our familiar way of being in relationship to ourselves and our world,
mm-hmm.
and that can include our relationship to whatever we consider God or spiritual kind of connection. And so I kind of think of the dark night of the soul, you know, that the mystics talk about, is it can be, people can feel, banished, actually, from their habitual spiritual experience, because that also is maturing. You know, we're coming into a more mature, individuated way of being. And I just want to note that, because that can be very scary for people. It's like, wow, even God's going away.
Right. And one of the things along with that, I think that's really important what you've pointed out. One of the things along with that, when I go through this with someone, is that, yes, relationships, if I'm having trouble relating to myself, I'm sure as heck having trouble relating to other people, particularly
yes,
loved ones in my life. And so I usually instruct them, just tell this person, who, you know, like your husband or your wife, that you're going through something, you don't know how long it will take, you still love them, you really want them to be there when you come through on the other side, but you have to pay attention to yourself right now.
I think that's very wise, because it's frightening for the people around us, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they love us, they're concerned, and they want to fix us, and they want us to be back on track. So to clarify that, and I think that's really, really wise.
Well, I think there's another important use for your book, and that is to have someone, say if I'm going through it, to have my husband be able to read that and go, oh, this is what's happening to her. Oh, my gosh. You know, that's really great. All right, so we have time for releasing. Tell us about releasing, the shift called releasing.
Okay, so you want to skip the stilling?
Oh, I'm sorry. I shifted pages. No, I don't want to skip the stilling.
Okay.
Go to the stilling.
If there's time, Eileen, I would love to, once we go through the shifts, is just tell a story of one person as she moves through the shifts, and that might bring it alive for people in a different way. Okay, the stilling can be, it's really the kind of the apex of being in the unknown. And the way I look at it now is, in the stilling, we're really being pulled into the moment, into the now, which we all think we want to be in the now. But once we're there, it can feel very strange. The stilling is really where we're suspended between two ways of being. We don't have access to our old way. That has unraveled. And we have not yet really entered into the new way. And so it can feel like a time of extreme nothingness, being in a fog, everything is, we can't even feel the pull and the longing anymore. And again, it can be to varying degrees, but it is a time where it's so important to just allow ourselves to be there, which is very challenging. And I kind of look at it as though there's maybe just a few strands left that are holding us and suspending us from our old way of being. And if we can just allow this, and in some ways to allow the stilling means to accept that we might be nothing, you know, because we can't see anything. You know, we can't see. Our old lens is no longer available, and we're used to projecting the next moment through our familiar way of being, and we can't do that. So it can feel like there's no next moment, you know.
Right.
So.
And another part of this, isn't this where this would also happen, where you get to the point of realizing that nothing really matters?
Right.
That's off-putting sometimes.
It really is. It really is, because we keep thinking. And what's really happening is what used to matter doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
And in deep change, when we come into a new depth, meaning is very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
So in the stilling, maybe I'll move on to the releasing. Is that?
Sure.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, anyway, the stilling, I think, is so important, and it can be the most strange and alienating place and the most difficult to put words to. But if we can allow ourselves just to be there, then often, and I'm going to tell a story in a minute, in the stilling, if we can allow it and pay attention to our experience, what are we present to, there is help so close by. And there are different signs, there's different almost little emissaries coming to help us. And what occurs then is that we move into the releasing. And the releasing is a real, real profound letting go of what is known and an entering into the unknown without any idea of what is or what isn't going to be. And what we discover is that we don't die, we don't end, there's no such thing as nothingness, and that we come into a more essential aspect of ourself that no longer has that former lens through which we usually project our next moment and anticipate the nature of the next moment. And so what's so miraculous to me in this discovery of the shifts is that in the releasing, we come into a way of being that I call kind of a fresh freedom. It's unmediated. So we come into kind of a radical receptivity to the world. And what we discover in that is that we are wanted, we are longed for in that state, and that we have this capacity to spread our awareness into the world we come into. And so that's the next shift, is the spreading. And by the way, the releasing, spreading, and holding, the last three shifts, can happen instantaneously, but I think it's useful to look at them individually in terms of what's occurring there. But in the spreading, I think I'll need to talk a little bit about the world that we are released into, because it's different than the world we had been in. And again, there's varying degrees of intensity. Sometimes we just find ourselves in a new place, and sometimes we have a real mystical experience. But the world, the new depth that we are released into, is a world of radical relatedness. People describe that there's space is filled with interconnectivity. Usually we think there's these distances. It's not a world of distances and causation. So it's very different. There's like a vibrating energy or experience of just that interconnection. And some people actually see that when they move into that space. And so in our ability to spread our awareness into this new depth, we start to experience and light up this new dimension with our own essential awareness. And we feel very connected, deep sense of belonging, sense of being welcomed and celebrated. And we can experience kind of different kinds of capacities, like being able to have multiple perspectives at once because we've spread. Some people will describe, well, I'm nowhere and I'm everywhere. You know, they maybe can experience a deep sense of connection with another person that they hadn't had before. And I know one person was saying that everything was shimmering at first, and the mountains were very familiar to her. You know, it's a world of intimacy and vividness. And again, it can be at varying degrees. But we don't stay necessarily in that state, but we are in a new way of being in ourself in the world. And I describe the holding, the spreading is sort of a soaring, you know, into this new way. And the holding is like a kind of a landing. And we don't go back to our old way, but we, like when a child has a new capacity, like learning to walk, it takes some time to learn how to use that new capacity. And I think in the holding, we exercise and practice our new new ways of being and kind of ground them. And people find themselves maybe going in new directions. There's like a different compass in their heart, a different compass and ways of listening to what's true and what needs to occur. We can give some examples, but those are the seven shifts. So maybe I'll stop here. And
I like that. My therapist Shirley used to describe that holding process as a result of having shifted from a stance in life where you lived on the basis of what you thought other people wanted you to be, into who you actually are, so that you've actually been. You've moved the locus of where you live from, and you're now living from inside of you, and nobody can take that away. It's a profound awareness that nobody can take it away from you. So you're not unsafe anymore.
Right, and it's very real experience. I like how Shirley described that.
Great. It was helpful. Yeah. So we're going to skip our second break because I have too many questions. I want to know about this.
Okay.
If you need one, let me know.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Well, I'm interested in children. One of the things that I'm working on these days is helping parents to parent in such a way that children can retain their awareness of themselves as souls, so that they don't have to, quote, find themselves later on.
Mm-hmm.
And, I would postulate maybe that's something that occurred with your mother, where she was able to stay more connected to herself. But I just wondered your take on if we could help people to remember more of who they actually are when they come to the earth, that they're not, that they're more like, at least from my perspective, souls living in human bodies. Do you think we would need to go through this process?
That's a really, really good question. I'm thinking about Kierkegaard. I don't know if you've read much about him, but
uh-huh.
he talks about this in a really interesting way where, you know, we have to separate from our family eventually to individuate. And
mm-hmm.
in that separation, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, we have to create something to hold us. And that's part of that identity that we create. And then, you know, I think that he would say that in deep change, then there is the fall, you know, the fall from innocence, and suddenly be aware there's all the space around us and that we are not being our true self. in that falling, you know, we might call that the releasing. Some people do feel like they're free falling. So I think to some degree there's probably always going to have to be some kind of a creation of a place to hold us until we have the maturity where we can let go of that identity. But maybe what's important, and I'm just speculating here, is the degree to which that, I mean, some people have had such a difficult time as children that the structure they build is a really strong fortress.
Mm-hmm.
And there's such a vulnerability, not the positive kind of vulnerability, but a fragility, let's say, and a rigidity that it makes it very, very difficult when that crisis occurs.
Yes.
But if someone has not had to forget as much and put aside so much, that might still occur, but maybe more gently and gradually, so that they have the ability to have it not be so dramatic, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, but that's how I'm thinking about that now. So going back to how we raise children, the more we can... I know with my son, I just was so aware over and over again that he is really different. His brain is different than mine, you know, and really paying attention to that and allowing that, I think is so important. So I'm so glad you're doing that work with children. But that's what I would say about it.
All right. So another area that you talk about in your book, Deep Change, that I think is really, really important to bring to people's attention is the fact that communities and groups and families and cultures can go through the deep change process. And, you know, these days where, you know, the church is falling apart and the banking systems are falling apart and so forth, people go, oh, that's so scary. And I go, look, it happens this way in individuals. It's happening on a cultural basis. This
mm-hmm.
is a good thing that we're falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about this. Tell us more mm-hmm. about that.
Well, I call it deep change of the collective, and I do think that it can happen in organizations and relationships, and I really think our whole culture is poised on the brink of deep change, if not, you know, in the midst of the unraveling. And I really feel quite passionate that we need an understanding of that so that we can pay attention again to the signs. What is wanting to come into being? You know, what is trying to emerge so that we can nurture that and support that and not just fall into the kind of despair that paralyzes us?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it's hard enough for an individual to go through deep change, but, for example, in a marriage, when suddenly, well, this doesn't mean anything anymore, and what happened to our love, and things seem pointless, it's so, it could be that we've outgrown that relationship and we need to change it, or it could be that we've outgrown the way that we have been in relationship and that marriage or that relationship can mature into a new phenomenon, a new kind of way of being together. And to have the guidance, you know, to be able to go through that sense of the stilling and the nothingness to find each other anew is very, very challenging. But I think really important I think in businesses, in nonprofit organizations, often we think, well, this is falling apart, this is unraveling, and maybe it's time for that particular organization to end, but perhaps not. Perhaps there is a new, more essential life that's trying to emerge in that organization, and to have the skills to, and the capacity really to notice that and watch that, and how can we look collectively towards what is trying to emerge, I think is a really important skill that we need to cultivate.
I'm sitting here puzzling how exactly to do that, and what, you know, I'm thinking like we need gun control, we need a new law, we need, those kinds of things are striking me as like our psychiatric meds on a personal basis, and I'm just, how do we do deep change collectively? What do we need to do differently?
Well, it's a really important question, and for example, I've been in a situation with a group where, and this is, you know, a small group. I mean, I think we have to do this in groups with each other, but we just express what is falling away and start to tune into kind of a collective sense of just even being with this sense of emptiness and unknown, and just holding that space and not trying, again, to fix or change anything. And then people start to, in their imaginations, things start to emerge collectively. And you give voice to them kind of in the center of this circle. And a different kind of life emerges. We don't do it very often, but it's kind of a practice of how do we listen together, and not just, you know, as individuals. I'm very, very fond of, I don't know if you're familiar with Parker Palmer.
No, I'm not.
Well, I think you'd really resonate with his work. He wrote a lot of books, but one is called A Hidden Wholeness. And he has developed this process. It's kind of Quaker-based, but it's called Circles of Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, for 30 years, I mean, it's been practiced, and I'm a facilitator of the Circles of Trust. And it's just so ripe for deep change, because it's all about how do we listen together without debating, fixing, changing, and start to experience this. He has a term called alone in community. And often we either feel alone or we feel like we give up ourselves in community. But this is a way to stay true to our own truth and yet start to experience the truth of the community as it emerges. So I would really, you know, if you're interested, recommend that Hidden Wholeness book. And many retreats that I do on deep change, I utilize the practices of the Circles of Trust. And
mm-hmm.
he wrote a recent book, his most recent, called Habits of the Heart, but how to have a democracy that I can't remember the subtitle, that is really honors human beings, and how can we bring that way of being into our national conversations?
Mm-hmm.
And we're so far from it, but he's really having groups and churches all over the country start to practice this way of listening to each other. You know, in a different way, where we're not arguing, we're not debating, and see what is the truth that emerges, what is the new.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way that I'm looking at that.
So, on the chat, Susan's message is a profound expression of even the most practical experiences of my life, and I love listening. From the first to these last words, she describes the shift to what I think of as entering into an interconnected relationship with life itself.
Mm. And where is that from?
That's off the chat.
Oh.
Utter Delight has offered that to us.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. I'll copy that and send it to you afterwards.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hold
on,
I really
to
appreciate
it.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for telling me about Parker Palmer also. So you had a story. You were going to tell us about the shifts, and I want you to do that, and then we're going to have to wrap up. So tell us the story.
Okay. This is a recent client in my practice in Santa Barbara, and she came to me first just feeling that she was concerned about her son, but what became clear is that she'd been having moments of feeling, what's the point of everything, and is this really all there is to life, and these feelings were very threatening to her. But as we worked together, so things became unsettled. That's it, the first shift. You know, things aren't holding anymore. And then eventually I asked her just to experience where was the sense of emptiness or pointlessness in her body. And she eventually came into her heart And what she discovered, and I'm saying this very quickly, this is over a period of time, she discovered that this empty, what she found in her heart, which she's going into the opening now, into herself, that it was a place where she was not there. And so she was not occupying this space. And that was surprising to her. As she let herself just be there in this place where she felt herself absent, she started to go into the unraveling and started to move down into new depths and depths that she had kind of abandoned before. And she had been in high school very interested in art and taking a lot of art classes, and her parents were both artists, and she moved into, revisited an experience where her father was extremely critical of her and her friends and her art, and also the fact that her parents were artists created a lot of economic instability in their family. And about 17 years old, 16 or 17, she had a very dramatic horse accident, and she was hospitalized for a long time. And at that age, when you're kind of feeling invincible, you know, and she really confronted a lot of vulnerability. And in the unraveling, Eileen, she realized that she had made a choice, a decision, it wasn't conscious, but she connected with that, to turn away from her art.
Wow.
You know, it was a source of criticism. She'd better get practical here. She'd better go in another direction. She felt, at a very early age, she felt, you know, just really vulnerable and from this accident. And so she, there was a lot of grief with that awareness of that decision, that she had turned away from such a large part of herself. And she continued to move through the unraveling into the stilling, where she was just suspended, just suspended in this place of nothingness, and she couldn't go back to how she was. And she was the main breadwinner for her own family, so this was rather threatening, you know, for her. And yet she just felt this sense of, you know, not being able to see the future, the next moment. And then, as often happens at this juncture, she got an invitation, and this was a literal invitation, also a metaphorical invitation, and it was an invitation to the, it makes me teary every time I think of it, an invitation to her high school art teacher's 70th, 80th birthday, something like that.
Oh, my gosh.
And she, yeah, it gives me goosebumps. And she, in her old way of being, she would have just discarded it. You know, that was a part of her life she no longer was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But in this place of the stilling, and this is important, we often take action without thinking of it. You know, we just move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so she
mm-hmm.
responded to the invitation, and I say she responded to the call, you know, and she went to the reunion. And in her, in the line when she was, reception line, she came up to her teacher, and it was, I think, an amazing moment where they just looked in each other's eyes. They both had tears, and the teacher was so happy she was there because she had experienced a lot of grief that this very, very talented student had turned away from her art. And I feel like there was a transmission that occurred there. And I feel like she moved then into just even going to the reunion was the releasing. And
mm-hmm.
then as she connected with this teacher, she allowed herself to move back into, I think she moved into the spreading at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And she went outside when she left the party, and she describes the stars were so intimate to her, the moon. The world had been so flat and colorless, and everything was vivid and alive, and she felt so alive and connected to everything. And she went home, and she couldn't even go inside, and this is moving to me, too. She started drawing for the first time on a napkin, and she couldn't stop drawing. And eventually, she set up, now that's the spreading, and then she moved into, she related to people differently. She started to connect with artists. And now we move into the holding, where she developed an art studio. She didn't quit her job right away, which was kind of administrative, but she started taking classes in art, doing art, and I still keep looking for her name in some art gallery, you know, about that. But then she came into, you know, this more authentic dimension with herself and then the world. And so that's kind of an overview of how those shifts occurred for her.
Wow.
I hope that kind of...
That's a beautiful story. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the key message, a key message at any rate, is that making deep change is normal, it's natural, It needs to be embraced rather than being pushed away or ignored or covered over or judged. And as I was thinking about it, we really need to be more childlike and mm-hmm. to embrace ourselves as we go through deep change, realizing and remembering that we're in the process, actually, of getting free.
Oh, that's beautifully said.
Wonderful. All right. Good, good. So that's
and,
the message.
And I would also add that we are not alone.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that is just a beautiful message, and I'm so excited to be able to talk with you about this topic.
Oh.
I do want to stay in contact with you.
I do, too. I really enjoyed this. Yeah.
Great. So, and you're helping us to live more authentic lives, to be connected with that something larger than ourselves and with each other while
mm-hmm.
we get free.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you for writing Deep Change.
Mm-hmm.
Remind people that your website is Susan P. Plummer, Plummer,
mm-hmm.
.com. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Sorry, I'm trying to pull it out of my brain. My brain's all filled up with what you've been talking about.
No, I'm doing a presentation. This is in Southern California at Irvine, UC Irvine, at the University Club with an organization called the Inside Edge, and that's people might be interested in that. It's on next Wednesday morning at 7 a.m., and I'll be giving a talk on presentation on my book. If people are in that area, it's open to the public at the University Club at UC Irvine.
Okay, great. So people can find out more about what you're doing and so forth on your website, which is
yes.
listed on both the chats, by the way. So
okay.
thank you, Dr. Susan Plummer. Thank you, Susan, for being with us today and for going over this and for doing the wonderful work that you've done that enables us to have this treasure.
Okay, well, thank you, Eileen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity.
Great. Great. Next week, join me for my conversation with Lee McCormick as we explore the spiritual and everyday process of recovery and find out what Lee McCormick has in his spirit recovery medicine bag. Be sure to listen on Thursday, August 28th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern Time. Thank you, Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media, for being our producer. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.